Good afternoon. My name is Don Ring. I'm on the geology faculty at Central Washington University. And the presentation this afternoon is on the geology of Eastern Washington, which in a way is a little bit perhaps broad, but I hope to perhaps condense it down a little bit, bring it a little bit closer to where we are here, but still give you some sort of general ideas about some of the geology that we have in this part of the state. I realize that many of you are from a number of different areas and different backgrounds. I know there are quite a few people here from around Portland, quite a few from Iowa, and you couldn't find much more divergent places than this. But I'm one who believes very strongly in exposing people to the geology of the area that they might be in or traveling through. And so what I want to do is to expose you to some of the things that you have seen along the way, or maybe I should say looked at, one of my favorite terms. People tend to look at geology, but they never see it. There's a really big difference, and hopefully when we're through, you'll get a chance to see some of this on your way out, because it's not possible to leave here without traveling through some of this area and getting a chance to see some of the local geology. Just a general word of introduction. The area I'm going to talk about primarily is called the Columbia Plateau. This is an area that takes in most of southeastern Washington. It's an area of very thick lava flows, probably, as best we can tell, perhaps the second largest area in the world in terms of these kinds of volcanic lava flows. If you're at all familiar with Washington, well, everybody talks about the lavas on the east side of the Cascades, and this is sort of what we're going to look at today. It's in a way sort of a two-part presentation, because going back to the same area tomorrow, but looking at something that is really geologically sort of incredible, the same area has been affected by a very huge flood also a number of years ago, and rather than try and condense everything into one presentation, I decided it would be best perhaps to try and tackle it over a period of 2 days or two times. If you have any questions as we go along, please raise your hand or pipe in. Once the lights go out, it's a little bit hard sometimes to see hands, but if you wanted to pose a question, why, please do so. I'm going to try and do this without getting too much involved in detailed terminology. Geologists have names for everything. The best thing I can say about it is at least they're not Latin names, which are rather difficult to remember, but if they're names that are not familiar, then of course it still doesn't make any difference. It might as well be Greek. So I will hopefully go along without getting you buried under a whole lot of brand new terminology. This is the physiographic map of the state of Washington. We are right up in this area in here along Lake Chelan. The area I'm going to talk about primarily is this area that shows up to be really quite flat in here, and this is what we call the Columbia Plateau. Now, a plateau by definition just describes a very high, flat region. In this case, it is rather high. It goes to 2,700 or 2,800 feet and then tapers down a little bit coming down this way. And it is underlain entirely by, as I said, the very large lava flows. It is also a basin. You may hear the term Columbia Basin. It's a basin because although it's a high, flat region, it does also have a very gradual tilt that goes down into the Tri-Cities area around Pasco and Richland and the Hanford area and through that part of the country. Now, the physiographic map, I think, very nicely shows up some of the differences that we see in terms of physiography and geology. Each area shows up a little bit different. There's an area up here north of the plateau. You can see the North Cascades where we are now. Even on here, they show up as a very high, rugged series of peaks. from about here, which is Snoqualmie Pass, the main cross-state highway going to Seattle, from Snoqualmie south, almost everything we see is volcanic in the Cascades. North of this, the rocks around here are mostly igneous rocks and metamorphic rocks, and they're really geologically kind of a mess. Things come and go very quickly, and there's been a lot of alteration, so the local geology is extremely complex, and for this reason, it would probably not serve any useful purpose to try and talk about the bedrock geology of the Holden area, because it's just simply too complicated. Over in here, we have what we call the Puget Lowland area, the region between the Cascades and the Olympics, the Olympic Peninsula up in here, and then another somewhat low hilly area that makes up the very southwestern part of the state. So each one of these then is a different geologic region, determined basically on the kind of rocks or by the kind of rock material that happens to be there. Well, this sort of ugly looking thing that looks like a modern psychedelic painting is the geologic map of the state. And it again kind of reflects, I think, some of the complexities. Again, notice the North Cascades. It's a whole series of rather violent colors, and it just simply bears out the fact that geologically the North Cascades are extremely complex, where the Southern Cascades, although there are some little differences in color, they are basically pretty much a uniform pattern or uniform appearance. And again, the Columbia Plateau shows up as being a fairly uniform thing with a lot of little strange patterns that show up in the basalt, and this is the result of the channel scablands. And as I said, we'll talk a little bit more about that tomorrow. The Columbia River basalts, as the collection of lava flows are actually known, they are basaltic rocks, came out of fractures or fissures in the ground. There really were no volcanoes as such. When we think of volcanoes, most people think of Mount Rainier or Mount Adams or Fujiyama or something like this. These were not volcanoes in that sense. They were simply large fractures or cracks in the ground. When the pressure was relieved on the underlying material, this lava came boiling to the surface under fairly high pressure, we assume, and at very high temperatures, because this type of lava material forms at high temperatures. Most of these fractures and fissures, as best we can tell, were in the area sort of along the Washington-Oregon border, but down in the southeastern part of Washington and the very northeastern part of Oregon. Now, this means then that the outline that you see in here is more or less the extent of the Columbia River basalts. So these basalts covered a layer across northern Oregon. They covered a rather large segment of southeastern Washington. They went actually quite a ways into western Washington and western Oregon, and I'll comment about that in a minute. So in order to envision what happened here, one has to imagine these lavas coming up out of the cracks or the fissures, just welling up, boiling up, and then spreading out very quickly. Actually, they may not be quite as dramatic as one might imagine, but doing a little calculation, it turns out that if they moved, probably 10 miles or 15 miles an hour, they could very easily spread over the area that they covered without too much difficulty in a day's time. But they do cover a very tremendous area in this part of the state. There are actually a number of different sequences of the flows. We don't honestly know how many there are, because they don't show up very well in most cases, and we expect that there are places where some probably exist that we might not see too very far away. But for those of you who live in Oregon, some of the flows did run all the way down about where the Columbia River is now, and eventually ran out to the coast. So if you're familiar with the area around Seaside and Cannon Beach, those beautiful big stacks and remnants that stand offshore there are actually Columbia River basalts. And we even find a few of them up on the Washington coast too. So A few remnants of this did get all the way across. It also means that when this happened, which was really probably about 17 to about 14 million years ago, when most of the lavas came out, it means that the Columbia River as such, and certainly the Cascades, didn't exist. The Columbia could have, and in fact, to some extent, probably did, but the Cascades, as we know them now, were certainly not there, because otherwise the lavas could not have gotten to the places that they did. It's very startling sometimes, as a geologist, even though we learn sometimes to expect surprises, to go out and look at a number of different places throughout the state and down into northern Oregon also, and find that we can determine or identify one single flow that has covered this entire region. And there are a number of flows that have done this. Now, not everyone covered the entire plateau. A lot of them were probably rather localized, but some of the larger flows have actually covered almost the entire Columbia Plateau, and this is thousands of square miles of area. So it's a rather startling thing to go out and imagine one flow boiling out for a period of time and then covering this larger region. We have some modern counterparts to this. Actually, some of the eruptions in Hawaii have followed somewhat the same pattern. Hawaii is basically a shield volcano, which means that it produces basaltic lavas, but those lavas come out of mostly out of a central vent or central opening. In the case of some of the Hawaiian lavas, there are occasionally fissures or fractures or rifts that appear along the margins of those volcanoes also, and then they do have or do allow the lavas to boil out and spread out from those points. Now, this is completely out of the plateau. This happens to be down in southern Idaho along the Snake River Plain, but you can see the fracture that goes right along here and see where the lavas have come up along the fracture and then spread out on either side. Now, this is a very small scale example. Actually, this white thing right here is a pretty good sized trailer house to give you at least some idea of scale. And you can see a little road in here, but basically, this is probably not more than half a mile wide. In the background, it's a little bit more impressive. Here you can see all this dark material in here is the basaltic lava that has come up along part of that fracture and then spread out over the surface. If you are familiar at all with some of the well-known areas in Idaho, this is not too far from the Craters of the Moon National Monument, which is quite a well-known area for recent volcanics. And in fact, Craters of the Moon came up right along this same fracture, only a little bit further north from here. So here we have an example of what the fissure looked like. And it's a very neat example because the reason for the trailer being here is that a number of years ago, a geologist was doing some exploring along the rift, and he discovered that down in the rift were a number of very large ice caves. Now, this is a desert region, a very high, dry plateau, but during the winter months, water, of course, falls in the desert in the form of snow, and then in the spring when it melts, it runs down into some of these fractures. Those fractures tend to be a sink for cold air, and oftentimes they'll remain below freezing when the surface may actually be warmer than that, and over a period of time, they gradually build up or accumulate ice. And if they don't have any kind of ventilation system, then that cold air will remain there as a sink, and the ice will stay there year-round. Well, that's what was found along the rift in here. So this gentleman came in and decided he would open this up as sort of a tourist attraction. And it was nice for a tourist attraction, but it was great for the geologist because when he got through tunneling, we had a really good opportunity to go down and see what one of these fissure systems actually looked like, at least as far down as we could go. So it did provide a little bit of insight into how the things operate. As one goes up along the Columbia River from Wenatchee to Chelan, the basalts show up way up on the north side of far side of the river. As you travel along, you have to look across the river to the east. And one of the strange things about this is that there are no basalts on the other side of the river. There are no basalts at all west of the river, or a very small patch north of the river as one goes along. These are all older rocks, some of the underlying material that was there before the basalts came out. Well, this also then suggests that the river was probably there before the last flows came along, and as they spread, they have gradually shoved the Columbia off to the north and off to the west, and now the Columbia makes an almost perfect outline of the basalt plateau. Once it gets a little bit south of Wenatchee, that changes, and the Columbia starts to swing back into the lavas again. But in this particular area, that's really not so. So as you travel back down toward Wenatchee, assuming most of you will probably go that way, you'll get a chance to look up and see some of the basalts in that high area. One of the truly distinctive things about a great many lava flows, and ours in particular, are that the lower part of the flow shows a very distinctly jointed pattern, what we call columnar jointing. It looks almost like somebody tied big bundles of posts together. And the upper part of the flow then is decidedly different. Surprising as it may seem, this is one flow. And the upper flow, there is fracturing and jointing and so forth, but it's very much smaller, very much finer, and it's very easy to look at some of these and think that it's actually two flows when it's not. To be perfectly honest, we don't know what causes columnar jointing. It's one of these things that frustrates geologists, because so many things occur that we can't actually observe. Nobody can observe what's going on while a basaltic lava flow is cooling, because what's going on is down in that molten rock. And our best guess is that it is probably the result of contraction or shrinking. I'm sure you've all seen a pond that's dried up and there are mud cracks there. And also observed the fact that the mud cracks look sort of nice and symmetrical, almost like some kind of a polygon that somebody had drawn out with an engineering scale. Well, the basalts are very much the same way, and in fact we think they probably formed the same way, that during the process of cooling the lavas have actually shrunk or contracted, and this has produced the columnar jointing. The size of the columns then would perhaps depend on how rapidly the cooling occurred. If the cooling was fairly fast, then the columns would likely be small. If the cooling was quite slow, then the columns are inclined to be somewhat bigger. Very common in different types of rocks, igneous rocks that cool rather quickly. Devil's Tower in Wyoming has spectacular big columns, and of course the Palisades in New York, and a number of other places around the world that are fairly famous. Looking at some of the flows along the Snake River, and again we're clear over on the east edge of the plateau. You can see some of the individual flows, and each time you see a little cliff or a little dark cliff like this, it is part of the columnar section. The grassy slopes are part of the upper portion of the flow, and I suppose here there must be probably 10 or 15 different flows. But this also points up one of the problems that we have in interpreting the Columbia River basalts. The only places that we can see them are places like this along the Snake River or the Columbia River or some of the streams that have cut down through them. And people say, well, gee, how come you don't know how many flows there are, and how come you don't know how far each one goes and everything like this? And my response is to say, looking at the lava flows is sort of like reading a book by looking at the edge of the page. We have a whole series of pages, so to speak, stacked up here, and we're looking at the edge of each one, and it would certainly be neat if we could open the book and see each page for what it is, but unfortunately we cannot, and consequently we're limited to making interpretations based on looking at the edge of the page. Another thing that is very puzzling, and you'll probably see some of this if you go through any of the lava country at all. Here again are some very well-developed columns, but look at these over on the side where they start to bend and look kind of screwy. the standard pattern for the columns is for them to be standing vertically, because the columns tend to form at right angles to the cooling surface. And since the lava flows tend to come out on a flat surface, the columns then are normally standing vertically. If the lavas are in a different attitude, then the columns sometimes have a different attitude too. But obviously there's some kind of a quirk going on in the cooling system here that we don't know about, and this tends to make the strange patterns. Here are some pretty large ones. They go all the way from little bitty things that are maybe a few inches across to some like this that are probably 6 or 8 feet across. You can see the fellow standing here beside them. And again, the only thing we can speculate is that they're caused by the rate of cooling that the lavas go through. These are right along the edge of Frenchman Springs Coulee, just south of Quincy, if that helps. Here are some along the edge of Grand Coulee, and unlike the ones I showed you earlier, look at the ones in here. They go almost every which way. These are what we sometimes call fan columns, because they make a very widespread or distinct fan pattern. And as I say, we don't really have any good reasonable explanation except to say there's something weird going on in the cooling system when they tend to form. Some other things that are fairly commonly associated with the flows, if you drive along almost any of the highways where they have cut through some of the flows, you're likely to see something like this. These little dark blotches here are perhaps 2 feet or 3 feet in diameter. These are what we call pillow lavas, and they're formed by the lava running into a lake or pond. We'll call it a lake. And as the lava comes into the water, it tends to roll up or ball up, and it makes these little spherical masses that we call pillows. The other stuff, the material that gets chilled very quickly, once, of course, the lava hits the water, there's a lot of steam and a lot of fragmented stuff that would be thrown around. I'm sure some of you have probably seen pictures of some of the Hawaiian lavas running into the ocean, and lots of steam and fragments thrown up. Well, that's what this yellowish stuff was, and then over the years it breaks down to make the yellowish material we see here. So the cuts like this are kind of neat, because we can guesstimate maybe that the water was about this deep, pretty much to the top of the slide. But it also tells us when we look at it then that these flows were erupted at a time when there was water on top of the plateau. And in fact, we do find a lot of signs of life, not so much life in terms of animal life, but lots of vegetation. And our areas in between the basalts are quite well known for the petrified wood. Almost always the petrified wood will be found in with these pillows, because most of the wood is in the edges of ponds or along the edges of streams, and then being very waterlogged and water-soaked, it wasn't burned up as the lava covered it over.
Question?
Yes?
Volcanic rock is often kind of porous?
The upper part of the flow usually is a very spongy material. It depends a little bit on how the eruptions occur. If we find truly porous rock, rock that is very lightweight and spongy, most of the time that's like a froth or a foam. Air will escape during the eruption, and it will blow some of the lava up into a frothy material, and that will cool in the air, and then it will come down as a very distinctly frothy or foamy material. In most of the flows like we see here, the upper part of the flow is full of a lot of holes, because as it cools, the gas bubbles tend to rise, but it really is not lightweight. It just simply looks like black Swiss cheese or something. These are the places, especially in the Northwest, where we find lots of old geode, cinder eggs, agate, things like this that end up being precipitated into these cavities. Cavities make a nice collection place for the agate. In the flow itself, the lower part, especially where the columns are, tends to be extremely firm, solid, so to speak. The porous or holy portion of it tends to be up in the upper part of the flow, because the gas bubbles will rise as it as it cools. So the lower portions usually are substantially more solid or harder. But anyway, place after place throughout the plateau where there are road cuts, we see some of the pillow lavas, yellowish material like this. I know some of you came here by going over across the Columbia and then up through Quincy and to Wenatchee that way. And you may have noticed up on the north, especially of the freeway, just a little way south of Quincy, what looked like snow or flour or something piled up on top of the surface. This is a material we call diatomite. Now, diatoms are little plants that live in lakes and ponds, and when they die, their skeletons collect as a layer, and if there are enough of them, and if the process goes on long enough, eventually there'll be a rather substantial accumulation of the diatom skeletons. And it's a very desirable material for filters, filter material, things like this, because it's non-reactive. It doesn't break down very readily, and so it's used quite extensively. And so in this area, it's mined, and this is some of the sort of the leavings, so to speak, that are up on top of the surface. But again, it is another indication that during the eruption of the flows, there were periods when things quieted down considerably, and streams came in, lakes came in. There are an occasional animal remain that has been found up in the Grand Coulee area, for instance. Spelunker or cave person a number of years ago was crawling around up on one of the cliffs, and he found a fairly small hole and decided he'd climb in and see why it was there. And he climbed inside, and there were a few scattered bones, and he didn't think too much about it. And then he noticed that it had a very odd shape, and so they made some casts of it, and it turned out that the hole was actually a rhinoceros. And the rhinoceros had apparently been lying on its back in the edge of a pond when the lava flow came along, and the flow hardened around the outline of the rhinoceros. And of course, over the years, it had decomposed and disappeared except for maybe a few bone fragments. And by some really strange quirk, during the erosion of Grand Coulee, the erosive agents had cut right down through the very edge of it so that it just simply exposed one leg, and yet all the rest of the mold was still there. Petrified woods. This is some of the diatomite in the edge of one of the mines, and again you can see that it's covered over here by a lava flow, and the lower part of the lava flow again is primarily palagonite or pillow lava. So we know that there were substantial periods when the plateau was rather quiet. Well, the next part of the story has to do with glaciation. And in this case, primarily what we call the continental glaciers. And I should take just a moment and set the stage here. In North America, the primary collection area for the big ice sheets or big continental glaciers was up in the vicinity of Hudson's Bay. And to imagine how they moved is sort of like imagining or watching pancake batter on a griddle. As long as you keep pouring the batter in the middle of the pancake, the edges will keep spreading out. And that's basically the way the large continental glaciers tended to move. The accumulation area was up in here, and as the ice got thicker and thicker and thicker, it just gradually started to spread out pretty much in all directions. Surprisingly enough, you can see up here in Alaska, there was quite an area that wasn't even glaciated during what we call the ice ages. Everybody tends to think that Alaska was probably the world's all-time refrigerator, but it was not. It was, in fact, extensive areas were not glaciated. There was one small area here in Wisconsin that was also ice-free because of some topographic characteristics that sort of split the ice flow, and the ice went around it without glaciating it. But the startling thing, I guess, is the fact that in the mid-continent, the ice went well down into the middle of the United States, into Iowa, Nebraska, Kansas. In fact, the standard glacial terminology still uses some of those terms from the Midwest. We call some of the particular glacial epochs Kansan and Nebraskan and so on. The primary reason for this is apparently the fact that there was nothing to stop it. There were no mountains, nothing to slow the ice down, and so it got the chance to penetrate very deeply. But as we go further west, then the ice began to encounter some of the mountains, and at that point it was not able to go quite as far south. So through Montana and northern Idaho and Washington, the ice just simply sort of crossed the Canadian border a little bit, and that's about all. In the Puget Sound area, it went down about as far as Olympia, the farthest penetration actually into the state. And then we're going to be looking at the area up here in the very, again, the northern part of the Columbia Plateau, which is sort of across the Lake Chelan from us here. So here we're back now essentially to Washington. Here is Spokane up here. This would be Seattle under about 4,000 feet of ice at this time. And you can see the edge of the so-called Puget Lobe here. We're going to talk primarily about the one that came down right in here, what is called the Okanagan Lobe. And there were, of course, the Spokane Lobe over in here, but this is the one that has caused most of the change. And again, we're now right up in here, sort of just off to the edge of that. But again, it's something you'll get a chance to look at later on. Here then is the lower tip of Lake Chelan. And the city of Chelan is right in here. This deep valley in here marks the path of the Columbia River. This is Grand Coulee, and I'll talk more about Grand Coulee tomorrow, because as I say, this is really sort of another story altogether, although somewhat related. This little flat area right in here is the only place that we really know where there are basaltic lavas on the north side of the Columbia. And the reason for this is that the channel of the Columbia used to go right up like this and then turn around and come back down here. When the glacier came along, it shoved the river out of that channel. It blocked the channel, and the river started to cut a new channel going across this way. And when the ice finally melted, that channel was deep enough to become a permanent channel. And at this point, the old abandoned channel just sits up there as kind of a high forlorn valley with nothing in it at all. As the glacier came down across this part of the plateau, it came just a little bit south of Lake Chelan, and then the edge of the ice went down about like this across the north part of the plateau, and then right up along the edge of Grand Coulee. And this is a very rather high, dry, primarily wheat farming area. Trees are a real treasure. In fact, they're almost non-existent. And the country is quite flat for the most part. And the glacial features that are there are truly spectacular, because there isn't the vegetation to cover them up. They've not been farmed. I know that some of you who live in Iowa grew up on glacial moraines. But our moraines out here, I think, are quite a bit different. For one thing, they're much more rocky. You've undoubtedly found rocks in places there, too, but I'll show you some rocks that I think would take a prize almost anywhere. One other thing, the glacier came right along the very edge of the Columbia here and up against the edge of the Cascades. And this meant then that any streams coming out of the Cascades, and this included Lake Chelan, or the Chelan River as it might have been at that time, ran into this ice blockade and were dammed or sort of hard-pressed in to make their way. And I'll show you some other examples of this in a moment. So here we're looking at the edge of a continental glacier, just on a cartoon diagram. Meltwater is coming out from under the glacier through tunnels. Some of the meltwater here is running into a stream. When the glacier leaves, if it has stayed around long enough, it will very commonly leave a pile of moraine, what we call an end moraine, that marks the terminus of the glacier. This is how far the glacier was actually able to go. Behind it, and sometimes in front of it also, we'll find places where blocks of ice got away from the front of the glacier, and the material that was being washed away from the glacier will surround those blocks of ice. When the ice melts, it leaves a hole or depression. And those are also fairly common in many of the glaciated regions. This is a moraine that was left by the last big glacier that came down across the northern plateau. We're looking to the north, and the moraine is actually this whole series of hills on the skyline. And in the foreground here, this is all the depositional material out in front of the glacier, what we sometimes call outwash. So it's a very spectacular moraine, certainly probably one of the biggest continental end moraines in North America. Very impressive as one travels. And you can see what I meant about trees. There really isn't anything here to mask the appearance. Here we're looking from the air down on the moraine. The edge of it is right here, as you can see, and then, of course, out in front is cropland, land that's extensively farmed because it isn't rocky. The farmers that are farming back in here are having to farm around the rocks because the moraines are extremely rocky, and a lot of the places are just simply too rocky to bother with at all. But you can imagine some of you that have farmed in Iowa having to farm like this around all the rocky places in order to get in the fields. But out here, where there is no rock to speak of, the land is farmed fence to fence. Well, this is just about due east of Chelan, right up. If you went across the river from Chelan on the little bridge that crosses there, and drove right, followed the highway right up on the top of the plateau, you would run right into some of this very same country. This is a deposit that was formed by the meltwater running through one of these tunnels underneath the glacier. The water carries all kinds of sand and gravel and things like this, and over a period of time it tends to gradually fill up the tunnel, and it makes a rather strange thing that looks, I say it looks kind of like a place where somebody buried a gigantic snake, because they tend to wind along. They are a ridge, not a valley or not a little depression, and this makes them sort of doubly surprising. You can see up in here the edge of a road to give you at least some idea of scale. Most of these are probably 20 to 50 feet high and probably 100 to 150 feet wide. A lot of places we find them going on literally for miles. As these were formed probably as the glacier was finally melting, for whatever reason the ice supply was finally cut off, the glacier would sit there and just simply melt like a gigantic ice cube that was stranded, and in the process the stream would run around underneath the glacier, and some of these things can be traced for 4 or 5 miles sort of intermittently. They're not necessarily continuous, but they do make a very striking pattern across the surface. Again, this is all behind the moraine, and most of this is as you can see here, still rather rocky ground. Most of the farmers that farm in here, as they run across rocks, they'll collect them and they'll throw them into a rock pile somewhere in the field, so that they collect them in some sort of a central area. But I'm sure it must be pretty tough on machinery. Another cartoon to show you a little bit of what happens to some of the glaciers if they happen to be confined to a small valley. We find places like this where some of the sedimentary material that's both washed down off the hillside and washed off the glacier will accumulate right along the edge of the glacier here. And of course, as the ice melts, those layers are eventually left rather high and dry up on the valley side. We can see one here, we can see another one over here, and you can see here one of the little depressions that was left in the ice. Here we see one of those sort of sinuous ridges that was formed in the meltwater tunnel. So fairly typical of deposits along the edge of a large glacial valley. Okay, again, we're back at Chelan, and we're looking across the river from Chelan. This is, well, the Columbia doesn't really show up particularly, but it's right down here. This is about a mile perhaps a mile north of Chelan if you go out of town like you were going to go to the North Cascades Highway or Pateras or something like that. But across the river, all these little terraces in them were formed as the glacier gradually shriveled away. The water kept seeking a lower and lower and lower level, and over the period of time formed really a great sequence of terraces all the way down. We see these same terraces on all the other rivers that come into the Columbia to the north of here, because the same thing has happened in those streams also. A little bit closer view, and again you can see some of the nice terrace levels here. Notice the dark things around here that are scattered through the terraces. These are huge boulders or rocks that were picked up by the glacier, carried along, and then when the glacier melted, they were just simply dropped as part of the moraine deposit. And the people up in this part of the country call them haystack rocks, because they're, a lot of them are about the size of some of the old haystacks that the farmers used to put up before they went to baling and chopping and things like this. This is a sort of typical haystack rock that slides backwards, but I guess it still shows the general pattern. Very nice one, courtesy of the Washington Department of Highways. As they came along here, they cut right into the edge of it, so we can see the big haystack rock standing on top of glacial moraine. Most of these were apparently picked up as the glacier crossed the Columbia. It would just simply tear out or gouge out these huge rocks, carry them along in the ice, and then as the glacier melted, they would simply be dropped wherever they happened to be. So there are some, this is not necessarily the biggest one, but this is again just east of Chelan, right up on top of the plateau. Some of you might imagine having a rock like this for a neighbor. A lot of the farms up in that part of the country will have a nice big haystack rock right next to the farm or scattered around like this. And I've often thought it must be a nightmare to farm this land and drive around through all the gigantic haystack rocks, because I'm sure they'd win any kind of a contest with farm machinery. Some of you that live perhaps in the Puget Sound area see the same sort of thing almost anywhere along one of the beaches. These came to us mostly courtesy of British Columbia. They're granites that were quarried by the glacier coming down through British Columbia, and over the years the erosion along the sea cliffs has exposed them, and so we find these big mostly granite boulders sitting all the way along the edge of the sound. And the same kind of thing, only on a much smaller scale. Now, a little bit north of us here, this is the valley of the Metow River. Some of you have probably been across the North Cascades Highway, the only real access to the North Cascades National Park. Well, the highway follows this valley then, the Metow Valley. And the Metow Valley was blocked by the glacier as it occupied this area, so the water used this as a diversion. It came down over the top of the ridge, the first low spot it could find, and cut at least this part of the channel. And now this is a little state park in here where you can see the small lake. And when the glacier melted, the channel had not been cut deep enough to become a permanent channel, so it sits up there rather high and dry. South of this picture, the river comes along and came through here, followed this valley, and this used to be the main Highway 97 going on north toward the northern part of the state. It's been rerouted now so that it goes just off to the left of the slide, but this valley in here then is part of that same channel. The river cut this channel as it came across here, flowing apparently parallel to the glacier, and again this it wasn't cut deep enough to become the permanent channel. And once the ice melted, why the Columbia went, or the Metow went back to its original channel. As you leave Chelan, whether you leave 25 Mile Creek or whether you leave Chelan proper, either road goes through a very deep, pronounced valley that people in this country call coulees. Now the term coulee applies to usually a fairly deep but dry valley. There's no sign of water in most of the coulees now. This happens to be the one that goes from Chelan on to the south toward Wenatchee, but the identical thing also goes from 25 Mile Creek south. I shouldn't say 25 Mile Creek, from about where Lake Chelan State Park is, about 10 miles further on down the lake. But either road then goes through one of these deep coulees. So apparently the glacier that blockaded Lake Chelan blockaded it two different times, and this particular channel here was probably cut first, and then the glacier pushed in, blockaded this one, and the water then had to go find another way out, and it cut the coulee that goes from Lake Chelan State Park across. So there are two more or less parallel, very high, dry channelways. And again, when the ice melted, neither one had become deep enough to be a permanent channel, and so the river went back into its original pattern. Now, I will take a minute and answer any questions you might have. We do have about 10 minutes before the first sitting, I think. Well, as I say, the best thing we can guess is that they're formed by shrinkage or contraction, just like when a pond dries up, all the stuff shrinks or becomes smaller, but it doesn't shrink from the edge in. It shrinks into a series of little centers, and as they shrink, they pull away from each other, and it tends to make rather flat surfaces. And as you look at mud cracks, they're usually really not very geometric in form. They collectively, they look rather geometric. Individually, they're kind of hit and miss, and that's the way the columns are too. Most of them are five-sided or six-sided, but when you look at them in a little bit of detail, why they're really kind of a poor job. They really are not very symmetrical. Some have are pretty good, but a lot of them have narrow points, and some only have three sides or four sides. But it's, we believe, a contraction feature or shrinkage feature.
Have you resolved Genesis in these millions and billions of years of geological time?
Have I resolved it? Yes, I have, at least in my mind.
Short explanation?
Well, I'll give you, I guess, my opinion. Let me start by asking you a question. What is a day? And then we could go from there. Genesis is just as exciting to me as a geologist. I don't believe in a literal translation of Genesis. I'll stand up here and say that right off the bat, because I'm convinced that it took a lot longer than 6 days. But the fact remains, what is a day? It's just as exciting to me that God had a hand in creating this earth we live on, whether it took 4 billion years, as we think, or whether it took 6 days, as some of the real diehard biblical interpreters think. And I don't have any qualms about this at all in my own mind. I have my opinion, and others have theirs.
John, you define a moraine as the edge of the glacier where it stops.
A deposit. Well, they really occur in several ways, but yeah, there are moraines at the end of the glacier, and there are also moraines underneath the glacier, because when the ice finally melts, everything that the glacier has in transport will just simply settle to the ground. So some of them are really rather high positive ridges, and others are just a general ground blanket or ground cover. Railroad Creek has been glaciated right up to the top of the peaks you see here, as best we can tell. Lake Chelan also is a glacial valley. It's and again, probably pretty much to the tops of any hills you might see. In fact, about 3 or 4 years ago, a geologist for the Geological Survey said that he had come to the conclusion that Lake Chelan was formed primarily by a segment of the continental glacier that had come down and crossed a little low ridge or low saddle up in the very north end of the lake, and then had come pretty much all the way on down the lake, where for years we thought it was caused by mountain glaciers, but like the glaciers coming out of Railroad Creek and out of the Stehekin and places like that. Now, they were part of it too, but he said that the Continental Glacier also filled part of that. So this area is completely glaciated, I guess would be a fair way to put it. That's what we call a hanging valley. It's just that the small glaciers like the one in Railroad Creek couldn't erode as fast as the big glacier in Lake Chelan. And where streams tend to merge at the same level, glaciers do not. The big glacier cuts faster, and so it leaves the smaller glacier sort of hung up on the side. And when all the ice melts, why, here's this valley sitting up on the side of the other valley, right behind us in Copper Basin is just a spectacular hanging valley. And that's the same thing that we find at the lower end of Railroad Creek. It's a hanging valley into Lake Chelan. Copper Creek is a hanging valley into Railroad Creek. The largest one is in India, sort of western India, called the Deccan Plateau. There are three really major ones. There's a fairly large one also in Brazil, but it's quite a unique area. Well, the valleys were very likely here before the glacier. The glacier always takes the path of least resistance, and that usually means going down a stream valley that's already there. And what the glacier does is just reshape it and deepen it and remodel it a bit. So like any moving fluid, it would choose to go through some path that was probably already there. So most of the time we suspect that there were already stream valleys present before the glacier came along. Thank you for your time.